Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franz. In a deadly weekend of gun violence across the U.S. In Massachusetts, a man opened fire at a social media party in the town of Methuen. Seven people struck by gunfire and injured another person sustained head injuries. Police still searching for a suspect. Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker.
Here we see again gun violence that's striking at the heart of a community.
Authorities say the motive unknown. Separate shootings on Saturday occurring in Cincinnati, Ohio at a park. Police say that after gunfire rang out, injuring five people, police still searching for those suspects. And in Michigan, a lone gunman went on a rampage at a splash pad, injuring nine, including two children. Excessive heat alerts hitting parts of the country, including Pennsylvania and the East Coast and the Mid-Atlantic, to Charleston, where temperatures are climbing into the 90s and triple digits. And in California, firefighters are battling wildfires in L.A. County, already charring more than 11,000 acres. This is ABC News. MLB umpire Pat Hoberg disciplined by Major League Baseball for violating the league's gambling rules. Hoberg denies those charges. The MLB has not disclosed what disciplinary action it's taking. So far, the league's investigation has not found evidence that games worked by Hoberg were compromised.
Hoberg is appealing the discipline, saying in a statement, "The integrity of baseball is one of the utmost importance to me. I look forward to the appeal process." Since the Supreme Court's 2018 decision striking down the federal law prohibiting sports gambling, its rising popularity continues to tarnish a league no stranger to scandal. Earlier this month, MLB banning San Diego Padres infielder Tucapita Marcano for life after a sportsbook informed league officials that he'd bet on games as an active player.
ABC's Ike Ajachi. Soaring summer heat in Saudi Arabia impacting the masses of pilgrims at Mecca for the final days of Hajj. Some pilgrims suffering heat stroke during a religious ritual for Muslims. Michelle Franz in ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Nightline with Pete Schwabba.
What is the worst movie franchise? Do you have one, Conrad?
What are your thoughts on Transformers?
I saw one Transformer movie. I think it was the first one. I didn't even know what the hell was going on.
I can't get into them anymore because, you know, it's the same every movie now.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice if you knew which Transformer. I know there's like testosterone and overload and whatever they, you know.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Mino and the Mayor. Radio Password with your host, John Mino.
The password is lingerie.
Jim, your first clue is from Mary. Mary says, sexy.
Is it a person?
No, it's not a person.
We can't say Mino. Lingerie.
Oh my God!
How is that possible? Mino and the Mayor, weekday morning 6 until 9 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. When Wisconsin farmers aren't working on corn, soy, or ginseng, there's a growing movement to plant cover crops. Mike Moen takes us over the border into Minnesota.
Cover crops are plants grown between commodity crops to prevent soil erosion and nitrates from flowing into nearby waterways, harming water quality and natural resources. John Stevens has adopted the practice for his farm operation north of the Twin Cities.
There's been years that we've had just phenomenal corn yields while you're standing in 10 to 12 inches of beautiful oat grass, and we did it with reduced fertilizer inputs.
He says that's good news for local creeks that connect with the St. Croix River. The latest Census of Agriculture released this year showed a 17% increase in cover crop acreage compared to 2017. There are federal programs administered by the USDA that help cover expenses for farmers who agree to plant cover crops. Stephen says they have become more flexible, but he suggests certain types of messaging to convince those still on the fence.
Sign up a 5 or 10 acre parcel and get your cover crops perfected on that 5 or 10 acres, and then you can just step into full scale.
Stevens indicates that approach might help avoid turning off farmers who run into obstacles after making big cover crop investments. There's also research indicating this practice doesn't always translate to higher yields. But he says that way of thinking needs some fine-tuning.
We've been taught decades of maximize your yield, And it's like, nope, that system doesn't work that way. You're going to reduce tillage costs.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some showers and thunderstorms around for this Father's Day. Winds a little breezy. High temperatures warming to the mid and upper 80s as some sunshine breaks out. In the overnight, we'll see more showers and storms, partly cloudy, lows dropping to the middle 70s. Right now, it's 73.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time when we're back in the studios of Madison celebrating our Civic Media Scotty Summer Text to Win win. Join us, all that and more, review of the weekend's news. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
And this is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media statewide here in Wisconsin and beyond in many other venues throughout this great nation. Thank you so much for joining me on this weekend weekly review of all things related to government and the rule of law, the administration of justice in our nation, and also beyond, often in other places around our globe. Amicus, a law review. Of course, we take our name, as always, from this word amicus. It's a legal term. It is derived, as you now know well, from the Latin. It describes a friend. Ami is the portion of that term that is relevant. That's an individual, an organization that somehow assists, promotes some understanding, some appreciation of some relevant issues, some things that are topical, focus of attention by a particular group or entity, and needing resolution, offering through this amicus process some information, some insight, or some perspective, some expertise that may be helpful to that entity in making a decision, understanding the world in which we live. And indeed, that is our mission. That's our purpose, our goal here on this broadcast every weekend. It also involves you as well, our listeners. We invite, strongly encourage your questions, your comments, your inquiries about what is always an ambitious but achievable syllabus here on Amicus, a law review, inviting you to call in at 844-967-2789, or also much available, accessible to text us. Drop us a note in our feed on the Civic Media app. Both Max and I are here this weekend in the broadcast studio of Civic Media. We're located in Waukesha, but you're taking your calls and your inquiries from across the state and beyond. That number once again, 844-967-2789. 2789 or the Civic Media app. Join us here on in our conversation of all things rule of law. Now, what is our syllabus this morning, this weekend here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media? It is, not surprisingly, a focus on the United States Supreme Court. As we have talked at great length in previous broadcasts of this show and others, this is a time period in America when our United States Supreme Court begins to issue, and does indeed issue, some of those major opinions that define who we are, both presently and in the future, not disappointing us at all. The Supreme Court now beginning to issue some of those cases. We're going to spend some time, a lot of time, this weekend talking about at least four of those cases that have dropped, so to speak, just this past week from the United States Supreme Court. Significant cases in the area of, yes, that's right, firearms, a significant case in the area of abortion, of labor, and also intellectual property, sort of to round out those four cases. The Supreme Court actually issued cases in six different areas just this past week. There's another case involving Chapter 11 proceedings, Another case involving remand proceedings and removal proceedings involving immigration issues. We're going to spend most of our time talking about those other four cases. And before we do that, to set some standards, to set some foundational work here, let's talk about where the Supreme Court is right now. Because, yes, it has begun to issue some of these critical, all-important rulings just this past week. And, yes, a bit in the previous weeks. But the reality is that out of the 62 cases that the Supreme Court has decided to review and analyze and give us its judgments on in this, the 2023-2024 term, the reality is that they have issued opinions in 38 of those, 38. So if my math is good, that means that there are 24 more cases for our highest court in the land to issue. And they have approximately 13 business days in which to do that. Now, the Supreme Court sets its own schedule, does not have to follow that kind of calendar at all. Traditionally, as we have likewise engaged here on this broadcast station and others around the state, as we have talked on a regular basis, it is common practice for the Supreme Court historically to issue these decisions in the month of June. And then somewhat into the month of July, very, very casually, the Independence Day holiday, of course, July 4th every year, is pretty much the end of their active, not term, but the active time of their issuing these opinions. And so between now and the 4th of July, there are 13, count them, a whopping 13 business days for the Supreme Court to issue these opinions. Now, it could, and it has rarely in the past, gone beyond that July 4th date, but highly likely that sometime in the next 13 business days, that of course is a bit more, right around 3 weeks or so, the Supreme Court is going to be issuing 24 different decisions. And so the speed with which these decisions are coming out from the Supreme Court presumably is going to increase. And on a decision day, so to speak, it may well be that the Supreme Court will issue 2, 3, sometimes even 4 opinions. And while that is not unprecedented, the reality is that in past years, the Supreme Court has been issuing these with somewhat greater regularity, even in this time, mid-June, late June, and then again right before the 4th of July. It has begun to do that, and there's no doubt that among the four cases we're going to talk about with great precision on this, our weekend broadcast, it still has a lot to do, many decisions, and it's entirely possible that some of those cases are still under review, perhaps still being drafted, still being exchanged among them. Not unusual, of course, for the Supreme Court to make some preliminary internal decisions about who is voting in what direction, and then those decisions, the majority opinion in any event, assigned to one of the justices to write, to issue ultimately. And it's entirely possible that those decisions, those drafts are now being prepared and that they're being exchanged to determine who is on the majority side, who may be dissenting, expressing disagreement with the majority opinions, all of that likely going on, who may be writing, as we will learn this weekend, who may be writing concurrences, that is, these opinions saying, I agree with the majority disposition, but there's something about that majority case, that resolution, that strikes me as wrong or needs more exposition. We'll see a bit of that this weekend on Amicus, a Law Review. All of that going on. And so what is, beyond the cases already decided just this past week and a bit previously, and again, it has decided 38 of the 62 cases, so it's beyond half, well beyond half, but still a lot of work to do. What are the kinds of things that are still on the docket, on this docket for the Supreme Court coming up in this term? Many of those cases we know that they're pending and they will be the subject of a lot of focus. We know that the immunity case involving Donald Trump, this claim that he has made that he is immune from prosecution, that has not yet been resolved, going to impact dramatically the pendency, the prosecution of that case, pending right now in front of Tanya Chutkan, but suspended, the trial suspended, while the Supreme Court determines whether or not a president of the United States of America is immune for some or perhaps some subset of crimes that he, perhaps one day she, will commit It is an extraordinary thing, as we have talked about at great length in the past, that the Supreme Court is taking this issue seriously, a matter rejected as being frivolous by me and many others out there who regarded this issue as frivolous, as ridiculous, and yet the Supreme Court perhaps headed toward defining some set of activities, criminal in nature, in which a president could engage that would not be subject to prosecution, a stunning thing that may be coming out. That is still pending. Prediction here, probably going to be issued among the very last cases of this term. We'll be focusing on that as well. The companion case, this Fisher case we've also talked about, that is the case asking whether or not one of the statutes under which Donald Trump and about 300 of the January 6 rioters have been prosecuted, some of them in process, many of them convicted, many of them sentenced under this particular statute. The question is, how do you apply that statute? And the language, as we've talked before, what does it mean? What is it intended to do? What does the legislature mean by establishing this particular statute? Does it apply to the rioters on the ground on January 6th? And derivatively, even though Donald Trump's name is not involved in that particular case called Fisher, how would that disposition impact, have an effect upon the case pending in front of Tanya Chutkan, that major election interference case? That's the federal case, four counts against Donald Trump, suspended by the pendency of those two cases. We have not yet heard from the Supreme Court on either one of those. There's a case involving emergency abortion care, which we know about as well, coming out of the state of Idaho, which has passed a ban on abortions. The interplay, the intersection, the conflict between that, the Idaho law, and a federal law that mandates, as it is interpreted by the Biden administration, mandates providing medical care, life-saving, health-promoting medical care for pregnant women if indeed that pregnancy is causing the nature of their physical harm, requiring that doctors, in appropriate circumstances, engage in those reproductive and abortion services. Arguably in violation of Idaho law, with the Supreme Court determining which one holds sway. Is it the state law? Is it the federal law? And determining whether or not the so-called supremacy clause that traditionally is a part of our understanding when it comes to these kinds of cases, whether the federal law is in fact the highest law in the land. That is still pending. We're going to talk about a gun case, a major case just issued on Friday of this past week. But there's another one pending, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, called Rahimi. The question there, determining whether or not someone who is subject to a state-imposed domestic violence restraining order can carry, can use weapons. There is a federal law that says, that is established a long time ago, that if, in fact, you are subject to a restraining order imposed by a state court, you can't possess, you can't buy, you can't sell, cannot use firearms. Mr. Rahimi, a very violent person, maintains that that's in violation of his Second Amendment rights under Bruin, under Heller, under other authorities that are out there. Supreme Court determining whether or not that federal law that prohibits him from possessing weapons is constitutional. Probably in that case, going to uphold the law. But we'll see. That case also pending. Restrictions on the homeless, that case also pending. Restrictions and limitations on social media providers and platforms. What can they do? What they cannot do? The prerogatives of legislators to impose requirements to provide information about any time that a platform provider brings down content, engages in what's called content moderation. Can legislatures restrict and direct the conduct of social media providers in those kinds of circumstances? We'll be talking more about all of this throughout our weekend broadcast. Stay with us here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
It's June Dairy Month, and though more than 5 million people call Wisconsin home, we share our state with close to 1.5 million cows. Those beautiful animals. Yes, okay, I grew up on a dairy farm outside of Green Bay. They've been here since before we became a state. Can you answer this? Most of our cow's milk currently makes which product? Is it butter, cheese, or ice cream? The answer coming up. Wisconsin's first official milk plant. 1894 in the Waupun area of Fond du Lac County. Fast forward more than 120 years, now farmer-owned with a second location in the Outagamie County village of Black Creek, the Saputo plant is even featured on History Channel's Modern Marvels for its award-winning cheesemaking. So did you guess? Most of her cow's milk, 90% of it currently makes cheese. Gouda for you. Celebrating our dairy farmers with this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour of our broadcast, and also the next hour as well. As always, inviting your questions and your inquiries about our syllabus at 844-967-2789. Also, very much encouraging your dropping a note to my producer, Max, or me on the Civic Media app. Likewise, presenting your question, your inquiry about the subject matter of our discussion this weekend. It is going to be all things Supreme Court this weekend because the Supreme Court, once again, becoming increasingly active in addressing its considerable important caseload in this term. Among the cases, as I was reviewing them, still to be resolved are cases related to social media. Lots of cases about the interaction between government and social media providers, platform providers. What is that all about? We'll find out from the Supreme Court. There is a major opioid settlement case involving a Purdue Pharma that is also the subject of review by the Supreme Court. Can a bankruptcy court, in resolving the Sackler family's financial situation there, can they basically stop other claims from going forward if those are a part of the overall bankruptcy plan and practice there? Supreme Court having before it the opioid crisis as it may in part imperfectly being resolved by the bankruptcy court. What is the power of that court in determining whether claims will survive beyond bankruptcy? A huge amount of attention, including some of the cases that we are going to be talking about this weekend on the power of federal agencies. As frequent listeners to this broadcast know, for a very long period of time, I maintain that these cases having to do with agency authorization, the attack on the so-called, although non-existent, administrative state, were among the most important cases in this docket until the Supreme Court began to entertain seriously the possibility, the ridiculous notion that a chief executive may be immune. These cases, nonetheless, are in a very, very close second spot, a number of them having to do with whether or not the federal courts should defer to agency determinations when it comes to understanding the laws of our land, the laws passed by our legislature, envisioning that agencies have authorities and prerogatives, and determining whether or not federal courts should defer appropriately under reasonable circumstances to the people inside those agencies who know what they're talking about. They're the experts of the people who have been experienced in the areas to which they have been assigned. The question in a number of cases, including a number of cases that go directly to this 40-year-old tradition called Chevron that contemplates that deference, is the Supreme Court going to toss that concept out? Number of cases addressing that issue, and we will talk about those as well as the Supreme Court issues those. Administrative issues loom very large in this term of the United States Supreme Court. Also a case involving cross-state air pollution, one of the only air quality cases, Ohio versus Environmental Protection Agency. The court there deciding whether to temporarily stop the Biden administration's so-called good neighbor plan that requires factories and power plants in some western and midwestern states to cut air pollution that drifts over the air into the eastern states. That also on the docket of the Supreme Court. That's among the 24 cases still to be decided. A lot of things happening in the month of June. And yes, indeed, on this broadcast and probably others of the broadcast stations generally of Civic Media, we're going to be talking about those because as this overly simplified review of the categories, the kinds of things the Supreme Court is addressing, indicates these are big deals, as a colleague of mine recently said. And among those big deals, some specific cases issued just this past week. We're going to talk about those. They have to do with bump stocks and guns. They have to do with abortion, a drug called mifepristone, which we have also talked about at great length on this broadcast. Involving case involving labor and Starbucks. And again, the authority, the responsibilities under the law with respect to union organizing. And then there is a seemingly frivolous but actually fairly important intellectual property case that the Supreme Court issued, which also generated, believe it or not, a lot of dissenting and concurring opinions by members of the Supreme Court on whether or not a particular phrase involving our former president, Donald Trump, can in fact be copyrighted under the laws of our federal government. All of that coming up. We know as well as all of this happens from the United States Supreme Court, this is the period, this is the time of year when they issue all of these cases. Even so, lots of things going on in the federal courts of our land. We know that the president's son, Hunter Biden, was convicted this past Tuesday of those violations of the federal firearms law. He is still facing tax evasion and tax issue counts out in California, even as the disposition of the firearms case in Delaware has now come to a close with a finding by a unanimous jury of guilt with respect to those particular charges. We know that Senator Bob Menendez continues to be tried in a federal district court in Manhattan, in New York. That goes on. A lot of fascinating and frankly troubling testimony about the nature of his engagement with overseas agents and authorities. What was he doing in connection with the use, perhaps, arguably, that's the allegation, of his own job, his own position as a United States senator? Was he accepting bribes? Was he selling his office? The government says yes. He says no and points principally to his spouse, among other things. She will be tried later on. But that case continues to be tried. And also another significant event having to do with Alex Jones just this past week. Alex Jones, again, in the land of reviews in these cases involving him and the imposition of a number of months ago of liability for the things he said, suggesting that the massacre of young people and others at Sandy Hook many years ago was not real, suffers these appropriately entered civil judgments. This past week, the judge overseeing the bankruptcy case there ordered the sale of Alex Jones's personal assets to try to begin to pay off those judgments in favor of the families of the victims of the Sandy Hook incident there. He does, however, keep InfoWars in place. That's the business. That's the online information providing a source from Alex Jones. Hesitate even to describe it that way because, again, InfoWars, the source of an awful lot of not just bad but downright inaccurate information. This past week, the judge ordering Alex Jones to sell much of his personal property, his assets, but keeps him on the air, if you will, even as all of those cases go ahead. Lots of things going on in the rule of law in America and beyond, including this major case that we have talked about before involving bump stocks. Supreme Court, just on Friday of this past week, striking down a ban, a prohibition on bump stocks entered administratively. This is a rule of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau, striking down that rule that enabled semi-automatic rifles to fire, that is bump stocks, enabling semi-automatic rifles to fire at speeds that basically rival those of machine guns. And it effectively, this decision by the Supreme Court just this past week, erases one of the government's rare firearm regulations that resulted from a mass shooting. Now, the decision, a 6-3 split, right down so-called ideological lines, this decision coming out just this past week, Justice Clarence Thomas, writing from the majority, said that, yes, indeed, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives has exceeded its powers when it prohibited the device by issuing a ruling, a limitation that classified these things, these bump stocks, as machine guns. He said this, "We hold that the semiotic rifle."
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franz. In a deadly weekend of gun violence across the U.S. In Massachusetts, a man opened fire at a social media party in the town of Methuen. Seven people struck by gunfire and injured another person, sustained head injuries. Police still searching for a suspect. Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker.
Here we see again gun violence that's striking at the heart of a community.
Authorities say the motive unknown. Separate shootings on Saturday occurring in Cincinnati, Ohio at a park. Police say that after gunfire rang out, injuring five people, police still searching for those suspects. And in Michigan, a lone gunman went on a rampage at a splash pad, injuring nine, including two children. Excessive heat alerts hitting parts of the country, including Pennsylvania and the East Coast and the Mid-Atlantic, to Charleston, where temperatures are climbing into the 90s in triple digits. And in California, firefighters are battling wildfires in L.A. County, already charring more than 11,000 acres. This is ABC.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Brewers head west. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers leave tonight for a West Coast road trip. They'll play the Angels tomorrow night. Then Thursday, they'll start a four-game series against the Padres. Last night, bottom of the fifth, two men on. Joey Ortiz at bat on Bally Sports Wisconsin.
Ortiz sends out in the air, deep left field. This is back. This is gone. Joey Ortiz. A three-run home run. Bernie hits the slide. And the Brewers strike for the first time here in the fifth inning.
The final, Milwaukee 3, the Reds 1. After the game, winning pitcher Bryce Wilson asked if he liked trading Corbin Burns to the Orioles for Joey Ortiz.
I mean, what's not to like? I mean, you guys put 290. I feel like when he came over, the big thing was the defense, and we've seen the defense, and I think the Orioles messed up. I'm not going to lie to you.
That's Bryce Wilson. We'll have a full recap of today's game coming up from AmFam Field. I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some showers and thunderstorms around for this Father's Day. Winds a little breezy. High temperatures warming to the mid and upper 80s as some sunshine breaks out. In the overnight, we'll see more showers and storms, partly cloudy, lows dropping to the middle 70s. Right now, it's 73.
1, 2, 3.
What you doing?
4, 5, 6. Counting the first place awards from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association.
WISS in Oshkosh for the best promo. WAUK in Waukesha, best Maggie Dawn show web story. WMDX in Madison, best web story about the Max Inc. radio show. And WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids for best show, interview, and promo.
Informed, entertained, connected.
And winning.
Your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
Pizza's here.
Oh, great. I'd love some, but I'm worried about my stomach issues.
If you're worried about having diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose, oily stools, it may not just be stomach issues. It could be a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and talk to your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
Over the past 20 years, Wisconsin has seen a huge increase in reported elder abuse cases. Elder abuse is the verbal, physical, emotional, sexual, or financial abuse of a senior citizen. It can also be the intentional or unintentional neglect of an older person. Wisconsin's population of seniors 65 and older is projected to grow significantly in the coming decades. That's why we all share the responsibility to help protect our seniors by recognizing and reporting any signs of elder abuse. If you believe that elder abuse has been inflicted upon yourself or someone you know, please report it. Call the Wisconsin Elder Abuse Hotline toll-free at 1-833-586-0107 or visit reportelderabusewi.org. Respect our elders. Report abuse. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Justice.
This project is supported by the Administration for Community Living, ACL, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, as part of a financial assistance award totaling $120,000 with 100% funding by ACL HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of nor an endorsement by ACL HHS or the U.S. government.
Maggie Dawn.
Coming up on the show, Maggie's back in the saddle, and we talk about Biden's top 100. This week, we're talking about the environment.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons at 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name, Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well, here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We're talking all things Supreme Court this weekend as a part of our talking with you about what's going on in the law, government, and the aspiration for justice, discussing in particular this major case issued just on Friday of this past week that strikes down a ban on bump stocks. Those, again, these devices that enable semi-automatic rifles to fire at speeds that are like those of machine guns. Machine guns under federal law prohibited. The question whether or not these particular devices can indeed be regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms by a 6-3 split court, not surprisingly, right down ideological lines. Justice Clarence Thomas writing, "We hold that a semi-automatic rifle equipped with a bump stock is not a machine gun, because it cannot fire more than one shot by a single function of the trigger." That's what he writes. The opinion, of course, includes several diagrams, which is somewhat atypical, several diagrams of the firing mechanism. Why? Because this issue, this determination about whether or not this indeed is a device that can be regulated, has to do with a very particular understanding of what it does and what it doesn't do. He describes in technical detail the internal workings of a firearm to show how a bump stock actually works. We're going to get back to that in just a moment or so and analyze exactly what the Supreme Court has said in an opinion that many people, including me, feel is very much focused on semantics, recognizing that lawyers love to do those kinds of things. Here you've got a Supreme Court that is holding very closely to the narrow language of the particular rule here and finding that the ATF does not have regulatory authority. It is undeniably a guns case, but more importantly, it's also a case involving this continuing review of administrative agencies. This time it's ATF, the administrator of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Right now, that is a fellow named Steve Dettelbach. He was a colleague of mine, still a friend of mine, former U.S. attorney under the Biden administration. We both worked for Eric Holder. He is a very good and decent person, advocating, of course, in his professional capacity, that this rule would be one that keeps people safe. The ATF being told by the Supreme Court, again, in this agency determination of just this past week, that it cannot enforce that rule, even though it comes from and derives from an horrific event. What do we know about that event? Well, we know on the night of October 1 of 2017, yes, it's been almost 7 years or so, a gunman who smuggled some rifles and reams of ammunition into a suite of rooms on the 32nd floor of a Las Vegas hotel opened fire. His target at the time, a crowd attending a Route 91 Harvest Country Musical Festival in the area just below that hotel. Gunman at that time killed 58 people and also himself. That's significant because we never really determined exactly what the motive for this was. What we do know is that hundreds more concert goers were also injured. In addition to the 58 people whose lives were lost that day, all of those injured in a very frantic rush to escape the rapid fire bursts. And that's relevant to this case. These rapid fire bursts of gunfire that were quite literally raining down from the room at the Mandalay Bay Resort where the gunman was positioned. Two of those who were wounded in that melee later on died. Now, about a dozen of the firearms, the rifles that this gunman used at the time, were later found by people investigating, the investigators themselves, the agents, the law enforcement, that they had been modified with these devices. Yes, that's right. The devices known as bump stocks. These devices, again, catch the attention, of course, of all of us. They're known. They've been out there for a while. And as a result of that, a huge amount of focus inside and outside government on whether or not these things, these bump stocks that enabled this gunman to engage in this absolutely catastrophic event in October of 2017, should they likewise be subject to restriction and outlaw by a rule, a restriction of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms? And we'll talk more about what the Trump administration in saying, yes, that they should, in fact, be limited. The accessories generally cost as little as about $99. They replace a rifle's standard stock, and that's the part that's held against the shoulder. The bump stock freeze the weapon to basically slide back and forth rapidly, which is something that the Supreme Court spent a lot of time talking about in its opinion of just this past week. It basically harnesses, it grabs the energy from the kickback that shooters feel when that weapon fires, and that makes a semi-automatic rifle more like a machine gun. The Las Vegas gunman, under those physics principles, was able to fire more than 1,000 rounds in about 11 minutes. 1,000 rounds in about 11 minutes. And so as a result of that, this attention paid in the wake of this horrific melee in October of 2017, the government, and in particular, the administration of Donald Trump, enacts this ban after this gunman does in fact accomplish what he plainly set out to do, one of the deadliest massacres in modern American history. The Trump administration then pursues this effort to stop the sale of bump stocks in America, successful in doing so. And that administrative ruling, of course, extended, continued, supported by the Biden administration. And indeed, in the wake of what happened in Las Vegas, people, good, reasonable, thoughtful people who are concerned about safety and security in America on all sides of the political aisle, people on the left, the right, in between, Republicans, Democrats, all supported a ban on bump stocks. The Trump administration, the Biden administration, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that knows what they're doing, these are the experts inside this agency, not just second-guessed, but told that they're wrong. And a narrowly written decision by the Supreme Court here focuses upon the language of this particular rule. The court, of course, has, as we indicate at the top of our broadcast, has at least one other major decision coming out that has to do with this Rahimi case and whether or not someone who is subject to a domestic violence restraining order can properly, legally, lawfully carry, use a firearm. That's a federal law as well. We haven't yet heard about that. That's a pretty much straightforward guns case. But here, in addition to invoking issues related to bump stocks and guns generally, this is also a case about whether or not the Supreme Court defers to the decision and the expertise inside of ATF under this precedent, this doctrine we've talked about a lot called Chevron. And again, it is in this category of cases in which the Supreme Court continues to address whether or not our federal agencies can do what they are assigned by the legislature to do. The bump stock decision of just this past week could indeed signal that these justices, at least the conservative justices on the court, could be in line to curb even more authorities of other administrative agencies out there. We know that the SEC is also on the line in another case. We know that a national fisheries agency, likewise in the big case pending out there, is also the subject of the Supreme Court's review. Now, Justice Sonia Sotomayor summarized her dissent from the bench. She disagreed very strongly with this opinion from the majority written by Justice Clarence Thomas. She is joined, not surprisingly, by Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who fire back in strong terms and say, no, this is just plain wrong, placing semantics and language over the practical import of what this rule is intended to do. Justice Sotomayor summarized her dissent from the bench, which is not unknown, but it's still rare. And it is undertaken by a Supreme Court justice when they feel very strongly about their position articulated in their dissent. The majority, Justice Sotomayor says, puts machine guns back in civilian hands. That's what she says from the bench. That's what she writes in her dissenting opinion. And here's what she says. She says, when I see a bird that walks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck. A bump stock, she goes on to say, a bump stock equipped semi-automatic rifle fires automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. It goes on to say, because I, like Congress, call that a machine gun, I respectfully dissent. And again, she's joined in that by Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, it's significant to know as well that under a thing called the National Firearms Act of 1934, Congress, our legislature, specifically outlawed machine guns. Those are defined as any weapon which shoots or designed to shoot or can readily be restored to shoot automatically
more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. Now, that sounds very, very specific. It is important because that's the language upon which this case turns. It is not a decision based upon the policy decisions here. That definition was expanded under something called the Gun Control Act of 1968, also by our legislature. It remains the law of our nation. It included that at that time parts that can be used to convert a weapon into a machine gun, a category that has been heavily regulated, including here with respect to bump stocks, by the ATF. As I indicated, the Supreme Court spending a lot of time talking about exactly what happens here, that bump stock freeing the weapon to slide back and forth. Justice Thomas spending a lot of time in his majority opinion talking about that, this kickback that shooters feel when the weapon fires. The justices appear divided over whether that counted as one pull of the trigger or multiple. And so you've got this opinion and the dissenting opinions that are focused on exactly what is going on when a bump stock is attached. Under the Trump administration rule, under the Biden rule, bump stocks were considered illegal. And as a result of that, this case now coming to the Supreme Court, the response of this from across the nation is, of course, strong. Those people who feel strongly, as I suspect many of you do, that safety and security, especially when it comes to firearms in America, has got to be one of our top priorities. We continue to have these major numbers of major shootings, mass shootings in America. We are still on track again in this calendar year to post record numbers of mass shootings. This is the kind of thing, it is a small thing, candidly, that ATF can and should do to try to keep us safe and secure. And the fact that the Supreme Court has now said, ATF, you can't do this, and has determined based upon the language of the law and the specific function how this thing works, it is disappointing at a minimum. All of this comes in the wake of the plaintiff, the petitioner here. His name is Mr. Cargill. He said he was working on his bed on his iPad when he refreshed the Supreme Court decision on this, and it came up. He said, I was ecstatic. This is the fellow who brought the case. And the first time, he said, for the first time in my life, I was at a loss for words. The case, of course, a victory for gun rights advocates and others, although once again, not so much a gun case as it is a case involving language and a case involving the capacity of agencies to do its job. A bump stock does not convert a semi-automatic rifle into a machine gun any more than a shooter with a lightning-fast trigger finger does. That's what Justice Clarence Thomas said at the time of his rendition of this opinion. Occurring opinion by Sam Alito largely agreed with that and says that there is simply no other way to read the statutory language. Alito goes on to say the horrible shooting spree in Las Vegas in 2017 did not change the statutory text or its meaning. There's a simple remedy for the disparate treatment of bump stocks and machine guns. He says Congress can amend the law. And again, Justice Sotomayor could not disagree more. What does she say? That today the court puts bump stocks back in civilian hands. To do so, it casts aside Congress's definition of machine gun and seizes upon one that is inconsistent with the ordinary meaning of the statutory text and is unsupported by the context or the purpose. She finally says, this is not a hard case. The majority opinion, she says, looks to the internal mechanism that initiates fire rather than the human act of the shooter's initial pull. That's an interpretation that requires six diagrams, she says, and an animation to decipher the meaning of the statutory text. She is plainly making reference to those things that show up in the opinion. Again, sometimes done, but it's atypical. And again, we have in the wake of this significant decision coming out of the Supreme Court just yesterday, a further diminution of the capacity of an agency, in this case ATF, to make decisions that keep us safe and secure. And also an opinion that reverses this all-important rule, this regulation by ATF with respect to bump stocks in our nation. That case coming out of the Supreme Court just on Friday of this past week, among the 62 that it has been reviewing. When we return here on Amicus Law Review, we're going to talk about yet another case, a series of cases on Thursday of this past week. Stay with us for that discussion.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
If you're grilling this weekend, be sure to have plenty of artisan hearth buns and rolls on hand. Fancy equipment and secret sauces are great, but once you've mastered the basics, it's all about the bun. Your perfectly grilled burgers and hot dogs deserve the best, and with several varieties to choose from, including Wisconsin brat buns, gourmet brioche, French, and onion rolls, the bakers of Artisan Hearth have the buns and rolls your family will love. Artisan Hearth, locally baked, delivered fresh daily.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Lawview. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour, next hour as well. It is a broadcast, a weekend broadcast, focusing on the Supreme Court almost exclusively because the Supreme Court, once again, beginning to issue some of these major opinions. We have spent a lot of time appropriately talking about this bump stock case. Why? Because it implicates both firearms in America, but even more centrally, it also represents another attack, if you will, by the Supreme Court on the determination by an agency, its actions intended to keep us safe and secure. Bump stocks, this rule regulating them, now tossed out by the Supreme Court, and they will now be legal in America as they were prior to the Trump administration, the Biden administration, restricting and prohibiting their sale, their use in America. On Thursday of this past week, the Supreme Court issued three other opinions in a variety of different areas. We're going to spend some time now beginning to talk about the first of those three cases. And yes, indeed, it is one of the two abortion cases pending before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, when it 2 years ago this month issued its opinion in Dobbs overturning Roe versus Wade, overturning 49 years of judicial precedent and history in our nation, basically was trying to send this issue, the abortion issue, back to the states, as it did, and determining that there is not a privacy right inside the Constitution that protects a woman's right to abortion as it had done for 49, almost 50 years prior to that, hoping plainly, that these matters would not now come back to it. And indeed, here they are. They're back again in at least two cases, including one of them involving a drug, one of the most commonly used drugs in accomplishing abortion, the medical service, the reproductive service in America. That drug, of course, is mifepristone. It is one of two principal drugs used for that legitimate, appropriate medical procedure involving a patient and a doctor. Supreme Court on Thursday maintaining access to that widely available abortion pill, and it rejected basically a petition by a group of anti-abortion organizations and some doctors to undo, and here we go again, another agency, the Food and Drug Administration's approval of that drug. And so this is both an abortion case, a reproductive rights case, a Privacy Rights Act case, but once again, it is determining whether or not an agency can, in fact, do what it has done in this particular case. In a unanimous decision, 9-0, unlike the bump stock case, this one is 9-0, supporting, upholding what the agency has done. It's written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The court held that these anti-abortion groups and the doctors lacked a direct state standing, if you will, in this dispute, a requirement to challenge this approval of the pill, mifepristone, by the FDA. Justice Kavanaugh saying, the plaintiffs do not prescribe or use mifepristone, and the FDA is not requiring them to do or refrain from doing anything. He added, a plaintiff's desire to make a drug less available for others does not establish standing to sue. Now, before we get back to the specifics in this particular case, let's talk, as we have before, more about standing. Because in the end,
this is not a decision that necessarily endorses or fails to endorse the drug, but basically says you've got the wrong plaintiffs here. The people who brought this case in the first place do not have an identifiable claim to make. Justice Antonin Scalia once said in another opinion that the standing doctrine basically requires plaintiffs to ask the question, what's it to you? That's what Justice Antonin Scalia said. The plaintiffs in this case, who are doctors and medical associations who oppose abortion, apparently had no good answer to that question, which is what Justice Kavanaugh was writing all about. The main theory there is that there was a statistical probability, according to this case, this Mifepristone case, that some doctors may at some point down the road, somehow, some way, work in an emergency room and have to treat patients suffering from complications after taking the pill, thereby subjecting the doctors to some kind of enormous stress and pressure and making them choose between their consciences and their professional obligations. That was a petition. That was the basis upon which these doctors and associations were seeking review by the court. That was their claim to standing. That was the argument that they were making, that they could, in fact, suffer damages here. Justice Kavanaugh, again, a majority, a unanimous Supreme Court, rejected that out of hand, said this: the plaintiff doctors and medical associations are unregulated parties who seek to challenge the FDA's regulation of others, italics in that language. Specifically, the court went on to say, the FDA's regulations apply to doctors prescribing mifepristone and to pregnant women taking mifepristone. This, again, all part of the unanimous opinion. But the plaintiff doctors, Kavanaugh writes, and medical associations do not prescribe or use mifepristone, and FDA has not required these plaintiffs to do anything or refrain from doing anything. Again, that's the key language in all of this. It is significant, he also wrote, that these so-called conscience protections that are in federal law, those exist, those are there, ensure that these very plaintiffs do not have to perform abortions or deal with possible complications from them. That was also a significant portion of the Supreme Court decision. The standing doctrine can mean that some legal questions will never get answered in federal court, Justice Kavanaugh wrote. Some issues, he wrote, may be left to the political and democratic processes. There are other avenues to try to limit the availability of the pills. That's what the justice wrote on behalf of the unanimous Supreme Court. And that language underscores this, that plainly the issue of mifepristone and its viability in America remains a possible target of attack. It remains legal today in the wake of this decision of just this past week, presumably as do other decisions by the FDA. The FDA for 25 years or so determining that FDA is indeed safe and secure to be taken based upon its analysis, its long level of expertise and testing for about a quarter century or so. This case, again, makes the determination that mifepristone can remain a part of our medical cabinet, if you will, but not based upon a finding about its efficacy, but rather that these particular plaintiffs challenging that are not properly here. Citizens and doctors who object to what the law allows others to do may always take their concerns to the executive and legislative branches and seek greater regulatory or legislative restrictions on certain activities, basically almost inviting, if you will, a future attack. That's in the opinion. That language is in the opinion of the Supreme Court coming out just this past week. That, of course, echoing this sentiment, again, in the court's 2020 decision that overturned Roe, which said that abortion issues should now be left to the elected branches. We've got more of that kind of language coming out in this particular case as well.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music critic Piet Levy, who joins the show to discuss all things Summerfest. We will also discuss the resurgence of the summer box office.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Water World, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded, and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.